you. Thanks for the kind words. Thanks for inviting me. So what I have here on the screen is a recent announcement from CUNY indicating that they're partnering with Hillel on a variety of efforts to attempt to at least somewhat improve the atmosphere for Jewish students in CUNY itself. And what I'm going to be talking about today, and then hopefully we'll get questions on as well, will be the situation within CUNY, which is the largest public university in the country, pre-pandemic around 250,000 students, a little bit less since then. Campuses around New York at both the graduate senior college and community college level, and an institution that has had a long history of sort of a welcoming environment for Jews, and also in general for pro-Israel sentiments, and at least on the latter has changed significantly in recent years. So what I wanted to talk about were what I see as kind of the three core elements of recent troubling developments within CUNY on the issue of how Israel and Zionism is presented on campus. And then I'll end with just a couple of very brief comments on how I think maybe things can improve. The first and the most significant, I think, involves the faculty union. So CUNY, like some, although not all, public universities, is a unionized entity. The union is called the Professional Staff Congress, or the PSC. It is one of only two. The delegate assembly for it is one of only two elected bodies CUNY-wide. The other is the University Faculty Senate. Since 2000, it has been run by an organization called the New Caucus, which is it presents itself as a social justice union. The last four of these elections have been uncontested. It's essentially a one-party state. The union is an oddly structured entity in that it includes senior college faculty, community college faculty, adjuncts, and staff, groups whose interests are not necessarily one and the same and often are in conflict. And for many years, it was headed, seven terms, was headed by a Queens College professor named Barbara Bowen, who was very, very left, but also a kind of savvy operator. And the union for years has struggled to achieve meaningful economic benefits for especially for full-time and tenured faculty, and so has promoted my interpretation of the union is that they're always imagining that it's 1968 at Columbia and they're engaged in some kind of revolutionary activity. And in this environment, hostility towards Israel has been consistent. I think we all know the basic profile of sort of a hard left academically that sees Israel as an imperialist settler colonialist state. But under Bowen's leadership, Bowen was at least smart enough to find ways to suppress these opinions. She was a kind of authoritarian leader of the union, because she recognized in New York that having an overtly anti-Israel policy for a public employee union was probably bad politics. That changes last year when Bowen finally departs, in large part because there was pressure from a left-wing group that she wasn't doing enough. She's replaced by a Brooklyn professor named James Davis, whose leadership was less effective. And shortly after Davis took over, we had the 2021 fighting in Gaza. And anti-Israel activists within the union leapt to activity. And what I have here on the screen is the initial resolution that the union proposed on events in Gaza, which was proposed by the union's international committee. Yes, the CUNY faculty union has its own foreign policy committee. which was striking in its language and its tone, you know, accusing Israel of massacring Palestinians, urging an outright divestment by CUNY, and in its most striking claim, an allegation that in 2014, Israel murdered, and this is the phrase that is used, 2,104, a very specific number of Palestinians. This this resolution was approved by this committee, which is part of the union, unanimously, and then it went on to the union as a whole. The executive council of the union, perhaps concerned that the union accusing Israel of murdering Palestinians may be too too much, introduced its own resolution, and this is a, this is the resolution that the union ultimately adopted. It was, you know, scarcely less extreme in its approach. It, you know, it labeled Israel as a settler colonial state. It accused Israel of apartheid. It accused Israel of massacring Palestinians. And in the most striking element to me, those of you who think back to the events of 2021, it suggests that the conflict should be seen as beginning on May 15th, 2021. So such a way to avoid the actual beginning of the conflict, you know, the kidnapping of the Israeli teens and the and murder in the West Bank. So there was this deliberate almost falsification of history. Now, the union had considered these anti-Israel resolutions previously. When I initially heard of this resolution, I figured that they would find a way to bottle it up. And instead, the union leadership, which and the union was conducting its business via via Zoom, the head of the union, Professor Davis, announced that he saw this activity as union business. So I thought we could all listen to a brief clip from the gathering in which he's making this description.
So folks should have received the resolution from the Executive Council in advance of the meeting. It was important to us, even though this was going to be moved as a substitute, to try to put it into the hands of delegates as far in advance of the meeting as possible. I'm going to speak to the motion briefly. I want to acknowledge the work that the three committees did. The three committees sought to challenge us all and respond to a crisis in which, you know, the committee felt that the United States and U.S. labor organizations are complicit in a crisis, and I appreciate them having developed that resolution and had a very good conversation with them about it. I appreciate their work very much. The Executive Council developed a different resolution because we felt that this was an issue that our members could potentially be persuaded is a union issue, a PSC issue, but that the original resolution simply asserted that as a fact or assumed it as a fact, and it jumped over the process of engaging our members around the very premise that this is a crisis, that's something that we as a labor union can and should do something about.
This description by Davis as of events in Gaza as a union issue, I think, is critical here. You know, in theory, the neither Netanyahu nor Biden were waking up in the morning wondering what the CUNY faculty union was thinking. The real target here was internal within CUNY, to position the union as supporting BDS, which is, as we're going to see, is sort of the critical goal here, and to provide a lesson to staff, to untenured faculty, to part-time faculty, that the union is an officially anti-Zionist entity, and if you want to speak up on behalf of Israel on the CUNY campuses, and you ever have to, if you need support from the union in some respect, you're not going to be able to count on it. And this sentiment was communicated, I think, rather clearly by Rosa Skillicott, who is the then vice president for part-timers within the union, talking about this, the goal of getting the union on board a BDS agenda.
This amendment does add more specificity to the ECE substitution. It does not call for us to support BDS without conversation. it calls for conversation for us to discuss BDS as well as the rest of the substance of the resolution. Therefore, I don't think it's more expansive. I think it is more specific. And I will say that, you know, as I mentioned on the listserv, I've done a lot of thinking about this over the last several days. And I personally have come to the conclusion that we as a union desperately need structured conversations that push ourselves and our members to confront this and not hide behind, well, it's complex and it's difficult and divisive. It is all of those things. And that is why we need conversations and conversations that have a specific guide to them. And so I am speaking in favor of this amendment and in favor of the resolution as a whole, but I support this amendment to the resolution.
This again is an academic union. We're representing academics. My sense is that most faculty members do not need the union to engage in structured conversations to tell us what to think. But of course, this was and is an exercise of power. The resolution was overwhelmingly approved. Several of the around 70% approval of the Faculty Delegate Assembly. Several of the people who voted against it only did so because they were mad that the more extreme original resolution did not get supported. The CUNY Chancellor, a Cuomo appointee, issued an extremely weak statement in response to the resolution, talking about difficult and painful conversations that needed to be had. I mean, you know, this he didn't seem to be supportive of the resolution, but certainly didn't criticize it in any way. Regardless, his house wound up being protested by some union activists. But this was a protest outside of his house, with the Free CUNY, Free Palestine line. And so the administration's efforts to kind of appease the group wound up not working. For those of you who haven't followed the inner workings of the CUNY faculty union, which hopefully is most of you, you might think, well, maybe this is just a union that engages a lot with foreign affairs. Well, that's not actually the case. They did consider many months after the invasion a resolution condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but wound up not voting for it. And the core element of they didn't vote one way or the other. And the core element of the resolution that was before the body somehow blamed NATO for events in Ukraine, which is sort of an odd way of sort of looking at things. So the core result of this vote were these union activity, BDS related discussions that occurred on every CUNY campus last fall. This is an example of the one that occurred at Baruch College. You'll see that they at Baruch they invited only speakers who were in favor of the kind of BDS approach. At Hostos Community College, James Davis, the president of the union, appeared, and he talked about his own personal experience with BDS. And so let's listen.
My own personal views on Israel-Palestine, and I was a member of the American Studies Association in 2013. Tony, when you were talking about that vote about BDS and voted in favor there.
So basically, we have a union whose president is pro-BDS, whose delegate assembly is strong pro-BDS, and which is really obsessed with the issue of Israel because they can't deliver on concrete efforts within the union. That said, there has been some pushback. There was this organization of which I was a part called Resign PSC, which was urging union members to resign, basically taking advantage of the Supreme Court's Janus decision from 2018, and telling people, if you one way of making the leadership of the union feel some heat is by withdrawing the dues that you pay. There were around 300 people who signed our pledge. Not all of them wound up going forward with the resignation, but the union, it cost the union some to embrace its anti-Zionist cause. And there was some Political blowback as well. Anna Kaplan, who's a Democratic state senator from Long Island, was just wonderful on this issue. She publicly criticized the union on multiple occasions. And Davis, in that appearance at Hostos, where he announced his previous support for BDS, admitted that there were other Democrats from Albany who had given him a call. And you know, the union's embrace of a BDS sympathizing approach and this incredibly dishonest view of events in Israel was depressing, but the willingness, especially of Kaplan, who I think is a real hero in this, was at least something in encouraging. So to me, this is the first aspect of understanding what's going on in CUNY, which is that you have, you know, for the administration or for faculty leaders in any way to express concern about attitudes towards Israel on campus, they know that doing so is going to confront a hardline anti-Zionist union, which means that, you know, for academic administrators who often don't have tons of courage, period, you know, not just at CUNY, anywhere, there may be a disincentive to move forward. And that brings us into, I think, the second element of the CUNY story. So CUNY is the three university-wide bodies. One is the Delegate Assembly of the PSC. The second is the University Faculty Senate, a faculty organization which has a lot of ideological overlap with the PSC. And the third of is the Board of Trustees, two-thirds of whom are appointed by the governor. So these were all Cuomo appointees, and one-third appointed by the mayor. And so basically you have a Board of Trustees that's a combination of Cuomo and de Blasio appointees. And the CUNY Board of Trustees, I came to CUNY in 1999, for much of the first decade of the 21st century was an imaginative, active, very impressive Board of Trustees presiding over a very impressive Chancellor Matthew Goldstein. All of those people are now gone from the scene. And the result is basically a board that were toadies of Cuomo. I mean, they basically were there to implement Cuomo's agenda. Their prime interest were particular forms of diversity, but even there, it was whatever Cuomo wanted, Cuomo was likely to get. And you know, within this, the administration's approach was, these are not anti-Zionist people in any respect, but they're largely indifferent to the issue. And at that point last summer, the New York City Council decided to look into events at CUNY. The chair of the council's higher ed committee, Councillor Genowitz, who was just wonderful on this issue, and then Anna Vernikoff, who's been very, very good. The chancellor, a date was set in early June. The chancellor at the last minute said he would not attend. The committee rescheduled for later in the month, and the day before the committee was supposed to, the second hearing was going to occur, the chancellor again announced that he was not going to attend. Instead, sent three senior CUNY administrators, one of whom opened her appearance by saying that she could only stay for an hour or so, and then she was going to leave. So the CUNY representation at this hearing was the senior administrator for student life and the senior vice chancellor for institutional affairs, who both came across as very sincere, but not terribly engaged. The opening portion of this, the committee heard from a variety of CUNY voices, and I wanted to briefly play an excerpt from one of my Brooklyn colleagues, David Brodsky, who's the chair of the Judaic Studies program at Brooklyn, talking about his experience and the experience of some of his students on this issue.
I've attended conferences and teachings by my colleagues in which they pontificate on what Judaism is and is not, without ever inquiring the opinion of those of us in the field. Worse, they declared from the outset that only their perspective was legitimate, labeling all others complicity to genocide. I attended anyway to listen and learn, only to find them regurgitating slightly updated versions of anti-Semitic canards straight out of the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the medieval blood libels. I obviously did not speak up because my perspective had been declared illegitimate from the outset. I document that in more detail in my written testimony. I firmly believe that my colleagues have the right to free speech to engage in anti-Semitism. but they don't have the right to silence those of us who disagree with them. My colleagues hide their hate speech behind lofty sounding names like the Cross CUNY Working Group Against Racism and Colonialism and the Brooklyn College Anti-Racist Coalition. It is therefore important that we call these groups out for the hate speech that they engage in. This affects not just Jewish faculty, but students as well, who report increasing fear of coming to campus. Jewish enrollment and attendance in in-person classes is down. Jewish students have testified to the administration that the vitriol against Israel is so severe that they are afraid to express their opinions and firsthand knowledge of Israel in class because they fear their grades will be affected. One student reported having a professor withhold giving her a letter of recommendation unless she clarified her position on Israel first. These students deserve to have their free speech supported. As professors, my colleagues wield power in the classroom. As state employees, they do not have the right to stifle student speech. This would be against the law even if the students were wrong, but it is especially egregious when they have firsthand knowledge of the situation and the professor's scholarship is not in the field.
The last points that David was making here, I think, are particularly important and particularly critical. The idea of faculty misusing and abusing their authority on this issue and this issue only in a way that it, on virtually any other issue, would be seen as intolerable. And these concerns were picked up by members of the council. And there were two exchanges with CUNY administrators that I think best captured some of the kind of problems here. The first was this exchange between a council member Vertikoff and the student life representative at CUNY, where the issue was improper conduct by faculty members and how CUNY would respond. Let's take a listen.
The question is really, do you believe that Jewish students can feel comfortable to express their views on the campus where faculty, the professors that are teaching these students and give them grades, endorse discrimination against the same students?
Can they? It is challenging when you are faced as an individual with a circumstance or a context where you feel people are against you. That's always going to be a challenge. I want to support what my colleague just said, though. I believe it is our responsibility and our opportunity to help our students acquire the skills and competencies to navigate those experiences, to be able to speak truth to power and to say, I'm uncomfortable with the way that that was handled, and hopefully we can get to a place where we together can be in this space of learning and intellectual engagement in such a way that we can move forward.
I think it's a perfectly reasonable response, and it's the sort of thing that, you know, that both the institution and the faculty should encourage of students. But what was interesting to me about the answer is that it didn't really engage with the question which was being asked, which is what responsibility, if any, does the institution have on behalf of faculty members who might be abusing their authority on the issue. And then to me, the high or maybe the low point of the exchange of the hearing came in this exchange again between Councilmember Vernikoff and Glenda Grace, who's the senior VC for institutional affairs, and VC Grace was she was very impressive, I thought, throughout the hearing, but reflected a kind of general institutional lack of curiosity as to why attitudes on CUNY campuses had become so hostile to Israel. And we sort of see this in this exchange.
Are you aware of any campaign on any CUNY campus to boycott, divest, and sanction any of these countries for their human rights violations? Russia?
Not aware, no.
China?
I'm not aware.
Iran?
I'm not aware.
Saudi Arabia?
I am not aware, no.
North Korea?
Not aware.
How about the State of Israel?
We've talked about the BDS resolutions that were passed at the law school, and we've condemned them. So yes, there have been about for Israel, yes.
Now, to me, the obvious follow-up here, and the line that, that in you would have liked to have seen the administration have taken, is to ask the question, why is it on our campuses that there seems to be this, this intense hostility to only one country in the world? You know, if in fact, you know, the CUNY environment is an activist pro-human rights environment, why don't we see lots of, you know, criticism of the Russian government or the Iranian government or the Chinese government? I think we all know the answer to that question. And that's not a question that the CUNY administration has been willing at all to entertain, because doing so may very well, you know, run it into some difficulties with broader approaches. And I think that brings us to the third issue with regards to CUNY, which is that, you know, my experience with CUNY students is that 99.9% of them, you know, they're wonderful to work with. They tend to be very, very hardworking. They're a delight to have in the classroom. But over the last several years, we have had these periodic instances of really troubling behavior, which, you know, which happen only once or twice a year institution-wide, but have created a general image of or buttressed a general image of hostility towards towards Jewish students in general, but in particular a kind of hardline anti-Zionist approach. And V.C. Grace mentioned in her response this episode at the CUNY Law School, which was the most recent of these affairs. So this was a resolution passed by the student government at CUNY Law, and you can see it on the screen. It called for CUNY to separate itself from birthright trips. It called for a full endorsement of BDS. It accused Israel of colonization, occupation, and war crimes, and it called for an end to all exchange programs with Israel. A very extreme document, and one of several disturbing episodes that occurred at CUNY Law over the last 18 months or so. But at the end of the day, you know, student governments pass resolutions, and those resolutions don't mean a tremendous amount. Where this one was different is that it got the apparently unanimous endorsement of the CUNY Law Faculty Senate. That is, that a CUNY body endorsed it. As V.C. Grace pointed out in her response to the chancellor, the chancellor did publicly condemn the decision of the faculty at CUNY Law, but as far as I can tell, the vote itself was not invalidated. And in theory, academics from Israel are free to apply for jobs at CUNY Law. But given that the law school's official policy is apparently support for BDS, it's very, very hard to imagine how an Israeli scholar could be fairly evaluated for any position there. And there have been similar instances. There was an episode at Brooklyn a few years ago where four Jewish students were removed from an event on campus that was featured Judith Butler at a pro-BDS platform. They were removed by the organizers, who apparently were afraid of the questions that they were going to ask. These episodes have popped up from time to time, but they create a difficult image. I do not see students as the primary problem at CUNY. I think the greater problem is the faculty, and to a lesser extent the administration. But these episodes are worth noting and are problematic. Before taking some questions, I just wanted to end with a couple of comments on what might be done. The first maybe is a comment of what I think should not be done. This is an excerpt I have on the screen. This is from a post that went up, I think, 2 days ago from Eugene Volokh, the law professor at UCLA, regarding this very, very troubling episode at Berkeley Law School, where nine student organizations passed resolutions saying that committing themselves not to invite Zionist speakers to come before them. And there's been this outcry about how to, how to respond. There's been pushback from the dean at Berkeley Law. And what Eugene pointed out in his post, with which I agree, there can't be a situation in which anti-Zionist episodes, initiatives from students can be, prohibited or really opposed in any way by the administration and still be comfortable with the First Amendment. And the danger here is both philosophical and practical. It's philosophical because the First Amendment applies even to speech that we don't like. It's practical because taking this approach, the minority on campus is the pro-Zionist position, and it's likely that this is going to be used against them. But what Eugene pointed out is that publicity does matter, and so things like the New York City Council initiative or Senator Kaplan speaking out really is very, very valuable. The fitting remedy he quoted for evil counsels is good ones because they rebut bad ideas, but they also identify those about whom we should be concerned. And so I think bringing more publicity to the issue is always a benefit. And then the last thing I wanted to point out is that in part because I've been at CUNY for a while, I have experience with trustees who did make a difference. And one of the most distressing things to me has been to see the Board of Trustees kind of recede from the challenge in this area. During the period from 2000 to 2010 or so, there were a handful of trustees, Randy Mastro, Kay Pacilli, and especially Jeff Weisenfeld, who were very active on this issue. And were people that you could, if there were issues that emerge, you could kind of go to them. And one of the things that I think that their experience showed is that individual leaders can make a difference simply by speaking out and bringing the episode. So it's not as if an individual trustee is going to change the mind of the CUNY faculty union. That simply is inconceivable under the current environment. But a willingness by trustees to speak out and to recognize that CUNY should encourage both pro-Zionist and anti-Zionist forces, that it should not simply be a kind of anti-Zionist zone, and it should not act in such a way in which students who are supportive of Israel feel discouraged from speaking out lest they be threatened or punished by faculty members or operate in a difficult environment. That seems to me is something that we need more of and something that realistically trustees can accomplish. And with that, hopefully people have some questions.
Thank you for that, Casey. There are a lot of questions, and thank you for sharing everything, and sharing the insights to all of this. I will let Alex, ask the first question, and then we will dive into the Q&A from the audience, and we'll take it from there.
Great. Well, again, let me echo Asaf's thanks for a great presentation on a terrible subject. And this is where we are, and I have lots of notes, and I'll only mention that so much of what you were describing about the internal political dynamics of the unions reminded me of the goings on in American labor in the 1920s and 30s, where various factions following the Communist Party line were forcing each other out and being pressured by anti-communists as well. So perhaps you're sort of in the David Dubinsky role here, an esoteric reference for the crowd. But let me get to my question. And you mentioned the role of trustees and politicians, and particularly that the Board of Trustees was appointed by Cuomo, who resigned in disgrace, although not enough disgrace, and de Blasio, who was sort of forced out in disgrace, but not nearly enough disgrace. And I guess my question is, how much of this phenomenon, this growth of anti-Israel politics in the guise of sort of anti-imperialism and really overt anti-Semitism within New York State's higher education system and within New York State as a whole, is really a function of the political establishment not using its bully pulpit and using its tools, like the ability to appoint trustees, and subsequently letting the inmates run the asylum. And I'll only note that New York State's gubernatorial election is next month, and the challenger, Lee Zeldin, who is rapidly rising in the polls, has mentioned this, whereas his challenge, the incumbent rather, Kathy Hochul, pretty much has not. And I think we can guess whose side the union is going to be on. But I wonder whether you have any comments about this larger kind of New York State specific and politically specific context.
Yeah, I think that it's an excellent question. And yeah, the trustees are, it's a weird body in that it's both mayoral and gubernatorial appointed. And I think in some ways, Cuomo and de Blasio are revealed different aspects of the problem. You know, for de Blasio, you have someone who saw anti-Semitism solely through the prism of threats from the far right. I mean, I'm thinking of this, which I know probably most of the people in the audience also have read, this the phenomenal piece that came out, I think it was last year, by Armin Rosen and Tablet, looking at the attacks on Jews in New York City and the utter indifference of de Blasio to deal with it, in part because de Blasio couldn't process a situation in which Jews were being attacked by figures other than, you know, neo-Nazi types. And, you know, CUNY does not have many neo-Nazi types or far-right anti-Semites, although doubtless there are a handful of them in various corners of the university. The problem with regards to attitudes towards Israel is almost exclusively coming from the left, or to a certain extent from Islamist forces. And that's not an issue that sort of computed from de Blasio's standpoint as well. And so, you know, in de Blasio's world, this is a problem that he couldn't understand. For Cuomo, I think it was a little bit different. Cuomo essentially saw CUNY as a way to promote broader agendas. I mean, as we all know, Cuomo looked in the mirror every morning and saw a future president of the United States. So that's not going to be happening, but this is what he thought. And I think in Cuomo's mind, the key goal of CUNY was to use it as a Templar that he could then point to on the presidential trail of how he advanced the cause of diversity. And the irony here is that CUNY is probably the most diverse institution in educational institution in the country. It's this extraordinary amalgam of students, and it's part of the wonderful environment of CUNY. But there was a particular kind of diversity that I think Cuomo wanted, which had a tendency to push the institution towards a particular kind of left anti-identity politics, in which Jews in general and the issue of Zionism really don't play out. So I think for different reasons, both Cuomo and de Blasio contributed to the problem at CUNY. And the contrast here was to Bloomberg and Pataki. I mean, in many ways you could think, well, for higher education, Republicans sometimes might not be good because Democrats support, as a rule of thumb, have more, will spend more money on higher ed than Republicans will. But with regards to CUNY, CUNY was much better off under the Pataki Bloomberg era than it was under the Cuomo de Blasio era.
Great. Alex, follow up, or should we go to the audience?
I have lots of follow ups, but let's go to the audience.
Yeah, we can come back. All right. So let me try to, deal with some of these questions here that we have. One of our members, John Dobrynicki, I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing his name, is asking if you're suggesting that faculty members resign from the faculty union and they give up their right to vote in the union elections and therefore cannot affect change. Any potential change. you know, isn't that similar to those who like threatened to, he's asking to like move to Canada, if Trump was elected or Biden or whatnot. So, I mean, you know, any comments about that is, I mean, I guess I would, you know, just maybe to, you know, expand from that, you know, is it, you know, is it worth being there or not being there, you know, in order to, you know, to at least have a voice being heard in order to try to affect some change, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think there are a couple of ways to answering that. The first is that one of the very early things that this new caucus group did was to restructure the dues fee in the union. So to a certain extent, this is getting too much down in the weeds, but in effect, what they did was to bump up dramatically the dues for full-time faculty and diminish the dues for staff and adjuncts. And so you have an odd situation in which the bulk of the dues are being paid by faculty who are not necessarily a majority in the union itself. And so resignation, which was disproportionately senior faculty who resigned, was a way to basically hurt the union leadership in, you know, where it counted, essentially in their pocketbooks, in a way that would have been unlikely to have succeeded more broadly. The second thing is that, you know, I would like to say that it would be possible to create a cross-campus union coalition that would vote these people out and, you know, bring in a kind of a more temperate organization, but that's simply not going to happen. I mean, the nature of CUNY politics, again, this is a group that's been unanimous, you know, it's running uncontested. Their only meaningful opposition actually comes from a leftist group who argues that they haven't gone out on an illegal strike. It's the equivalent of, you know, political equivalent of being a Republican in New York City or a Democrat in Mississippi or something like that. The ability to achieve change within the institution is close to non-existent. The ability to use, in this case, financial pressure to pressure the union has at least some impact. And I think the resignations did have an impact. The union was afraid enough that they actually contacted every person who resigned or proposed resigning, and the union hasn't taken what seemed to be the obvious next step, which was to formally endorse BDS. And the only reason that I can think of for that was that they worried that there would be additional resignations. I mean, it's clear that a majority of these people are in favor of BDS. So I think under the circumstances, this is something that those of us who founded this organization did talk about, that in a relatively weak position, it was a way to have influence that we were unlikely to have in another way.
Great, thank you. So moving on to Bud Gertesman's question, he's asking more of a broader question. You know, how does all this really affect the academic standard, larger CUNY? I mean, obviously you touched a bit, you know, on that, but, you know, what does all this mean as far as, obviously this is a kind of a microcosm of the degradation in what we're seeing in the academy at large, but, you know, are there any standards these days, you know, as far as, you know, taxpayer dollars and, you know, what people are paying for and what's the product that they're buying, you know, at large about this?
Yeah, this is the eternal question, I think, with regards to higher education, and, you know, to kind of the student life administrator, you know, Denise Maybank, you know, her comment was, well, students should kind of take the initiative here. I do think that, you know, parents have to take the initiative, that taxpayers have to take the initiative to kind of get a sense of what's going on, that they can't just sort of trust the institution. In a perfect world, you know, groups like the faculty union or some of these sort of indifferent administrators wouldn't have much influence. That's not the world that exists. Obviously, new faculty lines are assigned by by the administration. The hiring is done by the faculty. You know, the union is the faculty in this respect. But there are also people, you know, I mean, we all heard in the presentation from David Brodsky, who I think has been really courageous on this issue. There were a number of CUNY faculty, including some part-time CUNY faculty, who really took a lot of risk in speaking out, who publicly criticized the union. So I like to think that the, you know, among the faculty, the union itself represents an extreme vision that you know may have sufficient ideological support, but does not really embody what's actually done in the classroom. That said, if you go back to that that clip that I played of David Brodsky, you know, the concern that he expressed, and I've heard, you know, very similar concerns from, you know, from a significant number of students in the last several years about feeling restrained in the classroom and faculty members who are just kind of, you know, veering off in their own direction. This is always an issue. And here I'm afraid that publicity is not the best response, because it asks, it seems to me, too much of a student to publicly criticize a professor who is abusing his or her authority on this issue, because if they do so, they're going to be risking their grade.
Great, thank you. Let me try to combine these two questions, you know, just for the sake of time, and see if we can, you know, if you can tackle this. So Karen Fiss's question is that she's asking, you know, does the impossibility of changing the union leadership, does that not point to a problem of who is on the faculty itself? These are people teaching and indoctrinating students to be anti-Semites. Faculty who pass anti-Zionist is a litmus test. So that's one part of it. And Maurice Solovich is asking, you know, again, you know, as a kind of a combined, you know, related to Karen's question, is there a possibility of, if that's indeed the case, is there indeed a possibility of creating a new union or some kind of alternative, given if the reality is so set in stone and cannot be fixed? You want to comment on those two points?
Yeah, those are both good questions. In terms of the membership, it is important. The CUNY union is different from many academic unions in that the membership is, you know, it's not simply full-time faculty. There are also, you know, part-time faculty, adjuncts who, you know, may teach one or two courses a semester, and then it's staff. And for lots of the members of the union, Israel and Zionism is simply not their primary concern. And so it's not as if, you know, these people are necessarily the people who are going to be, I mean, some of them are, but they're not necessarily the representative of the people in the classroom. It's you know, in a perfect world, the way we would have it, and I guess this relates to the second question, you know, if there has to be an academic union, and there are broader problems with academic unions, I think, in that the primary threat to academic freedom on campuses often comes not from the outside, although of course we do see threats from the outside or even from administrators, but from other faculty. And so you have an odd situation in which the union members are on both sides. But in a perfect world, if you had unions at CUNY, it would be a situation where you had a union of full-time faculty, you had a union of part-time faculty, you had a union of staff that didn't necessarily have these competing interests. And so, and this kind of ties to the point that Alex was originally making, I do think there's an anti-Zionist core within the union, but they've used some of these other issues as a way of advancing their cause. In terms of whether another union can be established, part of the issue here is, you know, we are talking about academics, and, you know, most of us have you know, we have other things on our, you know, we're doing research, we're doing teaching. There are some like me who sort of engage in public commentary as well. But the willingness of academics to devote huge amounts of time to creating another union that might displace the current one is, you know, in a perfect world it would happen, but in the real world it's I think unlikely.
Great. So I have a follow-up, Casey, to, you know, everything you've been saying, and thank you for sharing all of that. You know, you mentioned, you know, Eugene Volokh, and you mentioned also what happened in Berkeley. You know, is there any, you know, as far as your discussion about the remedies, As far as legal actions, you know, regarding, you know, Title VI and, you know, what's been happening with the work that, you know, Ken Marcus has done at the, you know, at the Department of Education. I know that there were some folks, obviously, who resigned from the union, and, you know, there was threats about legal actions and whatnot. Is that, you know, is there in our toolbox there? Is there actions that can be taken that are positive, you know, given also, you know, the taxpayer dollars involved and everything else involved in New York with all this?
Yeah, I think that strikes me. You know, there are multiple areas that strike me as potentially promising in this regard. CUNY is like most institutions of higher education in that it does not like bad publicity. Lawsuits cause bad publicity. Criticism from politicians cause bad publicity, and you know, there are openings. My sense is that the current federal administration is not going to be terribly open to sort of Title VI complaints in this regard, but I could imagine, you know, let's say we get a different federal administration in 2020, it's DeSantis, or, you know, someone who takes a kind of different view on campus matters. I could imagine at that point complaints to the Office for Civil Rights and the Department of Education that would deal with these sorts of things. And, you know, in some ways the goal of you know, these sorts of initiatives is not necessarily even to win in court, although winning in court would be nice, or winning in the complaint, but forcing the institution to sort of come to the table. You know, the fact that they've done this partnership with Hillel, which, you know, a year ago would have been inconceivable, was a direct response to the city council choosing to you know, to act. And this was not the entire city council. You know, I suspect the entire city council wouldn't have been interested in this issue. There were four members who, you know, this is a 6-hour hearing. There were four members. They were there for most of the hearing. You know, Dinowitz and Vedekoff were there for the entire hearing, and that was enough to kind of prod CUNY to you know, to act in ways that would not have otherwise been possible. So pressure doesn't necessarily have to be winning a lawsuit or a legislator getting a law passed. It can be performing oversight roles in a variety of ways.
Great, thank you. I know we're coming close to an end, unfortunately, but let me give Alex the opportunity to ask the last question, given our time constraints, and hopefully, Casey, you can also come back and talk to us again at a later date. Alex, go ahead.
Sure. Why do, in your opinion, do highly educated faculty members focus so obsessively, exclusively on Israel? What's the motivation?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it?
That's why we saved it to the end. So
yes, I think here there are a variety of motivations. In part, I think it's because Israel is an easier target. You know, if you have the
easier than what?
Easier than the U.S. So, you know, these are people who often have very sharp criticisms of U.S. foreign policy. This was more prominent, it seems to me, maybe in the Bush years than is the case now, but even still now. So you can kind of criticize the U.S. approach to the world by criticizing a strong ally of the U.S., but not seeming to invite the blowback that you're going to get on the U.S. So part of it is that. Part of it is this, you know, this very, very peculiar ideology that exists in higher education that only, I think, very recently has spread into political culture. I mean, this is essentially the kind of the embodied by the squad, say, in Congress now. But even 6 years ago, you didn't see this kind of approach in politics, which is this image of the world. You know, it's a kind of Jeremy Corbyn image of the world, where you know, the West is evil and imperialist. That that Israel is the archetypical example of a settler colonial state. And if you recall from the Union resolution, they, you know, they have this identification, and Israel is a way of taking this approach. A third is, the Middle East Studies Association has endorsed BDS, and so, you know, on faculty, you know, on campus as a whole, Israel studies are relatively, Israel and Judaic studies are relatively minor, and even Israel studies, this has been a big issue in recent months, often has faculty who are sharply critical of Israel. And then the last last kind of element of this is a peculiarly academic, I mean, apart from just overt anti-Semitism, which is present, but I don't think it's a sufficient explanation, a particularly a campus approach of people who sort of embody this hardline left-wing anti-Zionism, and see Israel as the embodiment of evil in this respect. I mean, this is an ideology that I think has very little support actually outside of campus, but is quite prominent within. So in this respect, Israel has the misfortune of being a convenient and easy target in a bunch for people with a bunch of different approaches, and in an environment in which there are on most campuses, I think, very few faculty supporters of Israel. And I suspect it's a combination of all of those things coming together.
So basically you're saying that it's a view of Israel as the little Satan to the American great Satan. And yes. Israel is the Jew among nations.
Correct. Yes. And
it's not complicated by anti-imperialism as such.
But I think in that respect, there is a view of Israel as an archetypical imperialist power. I mean, if you look at we sort of saw this with the Union approach. You start with the CUNY law BDS approach. Israel is always identified as an imperialist power. And that, that's an element of this left-wing approach. But I'm not sure even that's sufficient, because there are other imperialist powers that don't get the criticism. I mean, the Union did not didn't pass a delegate assembly resolution criticizing Russia for invading Ukraine. That's an act of imperialism, but that doesn't fit into their agenda. There's a racial element here as well. Israel is seen as a white country. Its enemies are not, even though this is a particular racial view, but the imposition of racial elements, I think, has played a role. I don't think there's a single explanation for what's going on.
Great. Thank you both. Casey, really, I want to thank you for taking the time to share everything with us. Thank you for everything you do, and obviously for being the voice of reason and fighting the good fight there. I mean, obviously, we all of us have been friends and colleagues for years, and we're always here for you. But you've been on the ground and doing the hand-to-hand combat, and so it's obviously it's an uphill battle, and obviously the politics involved with all of this are not making this easier. So we're lucky to have you on the front lines, and we're here to support you in every way we can as well. I want to thank everybody, as always, for joining us this afternoon. I know that I did not get to everybody's questions. As I said before, please email us at bdsmoderate@spme.org, and we will do our best to respond in a timely fashion. I want to thank Alex, as always, for joining me, and of course you, Casey, for giving your time this afternoon. I hope you can come back if there are more developments and we can talk more again. Be on the lookout for future webinars. We're actually having another one with Donna Devine in about a week and a half about the upcoming Israeli elections. So more politics are coming down the road as far as why Israel is going to a fifth election in 3.5 years. Always good to challenge all of that. Again, I want to wish everybody a good day. I hope everybody's staying well and safe. And we look forward to seeing everybody soon. So thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.